This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. Oftentimes in the world of water conservation, you have to convince people to use less. Well, that doesn't apply in all instances.
The toilet is a toilet, and so it's no behavior change whatsoever. You just literally save water with every flush.
We'll explore how Western cities are using less water by making a visit to a bathroom in Longmont.
Ew.
I promise it will be cool.
Okay. Tiny houses tend to have tiny bathrooms that are very efficient, but these diminutive dwellings also have one huge issue that hasn't been solved yet: where to put them. And since the trend isn't slowing down, tiny house enthusiasts are hoping for a fix.
Then we'll go from tiny indoor spaces to the great outdoors. Rocky Mountain National Park is beautiful, but it can also be perilous, which leads to a lot of rescues. That's especially true on hikes to the summit of Long's Peak.
Lightning, sleet, hail, high winds, clouds, iced up conditions. That can happen in August.
Data shows there's a search and rescue incident there almost every other day.
Wow.
We'll have more on how much those rescues cost and who pays.
Plus, our film critic Howie Mofshevitz reviews an Elvis documentary.
But first, opening up a wildlife refuge to the public isn't the easiest thing to do under ordinary circumstances, and it's exponentially more difficult when the refuge is near a former nuclear weapons facility. Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge, west of Denver, has been back in the news recently. Now, it's supposed to open up to visitors in September, but a group of activists has brought a lawsuit to stop that from happening. Last August, KUNC's Kyra Buckley delved into the controversy surrounding Rocky Flats. Here's what she found.
It's been more than 20 years since workers at Rocky Flats manufactured plutonium triggers for thermonuclear bombs. Since then, it's gone through a decade-long, multi-billion-dollar cleanup, been deemed safe by three government agencies, and has been recognized as a protected wildlife refuge. In most settings, the sheer mention of nuclear waste brings up tension. Just ask John Lipsky.
No, I don't believe the cleanup was conducted even to the specifications of what the government wanted. You know, numbers lie and liars figure.
Lipsky is a former FBI agent. Back in 1989, he and members of the Environmental Protection Agency raided the facility for suspected violations of environmental law. But David Abelson has a different take on things. He worked on policy regarding the site in 1995.
When we look at, for instance, the initial soil cleanup levels for plutonium when we started and where we ended up, I mean, it is a stunning change.
Abelson is now the executive director of the Rocky Flats Stewardship Council. Congress passed a law in 2001 protecting Rocky Flats as a national wildlife refuge. And while today elk, deer, and Preble's Meadow jumping mice have free rein at the site, it is only open to the public through guided tours. And John Lipsky believes it shouldn't be open to the public at all. He supports the environmental and activist groups suing the Fish and Wildlife Service over the center. They say more testing needs to be done, and Lipsky doubts the government's claims that the area is safe.
The Department of Energy controls the variegated science at Rocky Flats. It's colorful for them, but when they start trying to convince other people, and there are experts in this world that say that even the respirable dust of plutonium is dangerous, fatal. It can cause problems with DNA, so your children might survive it, but you might have grandchildren that are messed up. So how is it safe?
David Abelson closely watched the cleanup process when he was a congressional staffer for Democratic Colorado U.S. Representative David Skaggs, and then as executive director for a coalition of local governments surrounding Rocky Flats. While there is an increased cancer risk, less than a millionth of a percent, according to government data, he says people could make their own decision on whether or not to visit the site.
Everybody should be naturally skeptical when it comes to nuclear weapons facility about the data. But what you see over time and what you see over the years through multiple parties within government and outside of government looking at the data and reaching the same conclusion, that over time what you realize is that there's enough parameters around the gathering of data that you can trust it.
The Department of Energy still runs the most contaminated inner part of the site, known as the Central Operable Unit, which will not open to the public. Federal law requires a review of that area every 5 years. The most recent one was this month. It says precautions put in place after the cleanup are protecting people and the environment. Colorado also has regulatory and some oversight authority over parts of the site. Lindsay Masters is with the Department of Public Health and the Environment. She says the initial reports after the cleanup ended in 2005 showed Rocky Flats is safe.
That was based on soil data, surface soil, subsurface soil, sediment, groundwater, surface water data. And in addition, there is residual contamination in the central operable unit, and agencies have not walked away from their responsibility to oversee that.
But John Lipsky says after the environmental violations he investigated before the 1989 raid, the public should not be enticed to Rocky Flats with a visitor center.
It's going to take everybody, as it always does, being aware of the issue, looking into it, and making the decision, and then speaking up. And we'll negate the science that the government has come up with.
The five environmental and neighborhood association groups seeking to stop the building of the visitor center were dealt a setback in June when a federal district court judge said their filing was premature because work won't begin until next year. They have asked that judge to reconsider her decision and are waiting to hear back. If the preliminary injunction is still denied, the groups plan to appeal to the circuit court.
That was KUNC's Kyra Buckley reporting on Rocky Flats, and she joins me now. Hey, Kyra.
Hey, Carly.
Activists opposed to opening Rocky Flats to the public were back in court this week. What were they arguing?
They're seeking what's called a preliminary injunction.
Isn't that the thing they were asking for last year?
Yeah, but at that point, the judge dismissed it because, well, it was too preliminary. That was because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was still working out details of their plan to open up Rocky Flats to the public, but now the agency says it will open up trails at the refuge in September. So activists have revived their request for a preliminary injunction to stop that from happening.
Why don't activists want it open now?
Well, I spoke with Randy Stafford, one of the plaintiffs in the case, and here's what he said about why the judge should bar the Fish and Wildlife Service from opening up the refuge.
The grounds of the refuge are contaminated with plutonium and other contaminants from the former nuclear weapons plant, and the refuge grounds were not remediated at all during the Rocky Flats cleanup, so the contamination is still there.
That doesn't sound good. How did lawyers for the government respond?
So it's not really in dispute that some contamination still exists at the site. What is in question is if it's present in levels harmful to human health. Lawyers for the government say that after that $7 billion Superfund cleanup was completed in 2007, that the site is safe.
And the activists disagreed with that assessment, right?
Yep. They had a handful of witnesses armed with their own research, basically arguing that the government's data is too old and that more safety tests should be done before even considering allowing the public on site. And it's worth noting that it's not just this group of plaintiffs concerned. The town of Superior has also filed a similar lawsuit, and school districts across Colorado have already said they will ban field trips to the site.
Did the judge even decide if the refuge should open or not?
We're still waiting to find out. The judge did not immediately issue a ruling, but is expected to soon. However, if the judge sides with the government, the plaintiffs plan to appeal.
I wonder how it'll turn out. Thanks, Kyra.
No problem.
Houses have become very popular. These dwellings of 600 square feet or less have been featured prominently on HGTV, DIY tutorials, and on YouTube.
And my own TV.
You've got the fever. Well, for something so small, tiny houses have run into big problems. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel has more.
One way the enthusiasm is spreading is the growing number of tiny house festivals. Yep, you heard that right. From Vermont to Florida to California, these multi-day festivals bring together owners, builders, potential buyers, and people like me who just want to look.
So it's so open in here. How tall are the ceilings?
So I went to the Colorado Tiny House Festival at Adams County Fairground last month. Builder Art LeBach organized the event.
We've got a bunch of different tiny house structures that we all get together and really try to progress the tiny house movement through education.
One of the houses I toured belongs to Allie Shea.
Come in.
Okay. Stepping into Shea's home, I'm right in the kitchen. It's in the middle between the one closet and a small living room.
I ended up having like 5 feet of counter space, which is pretty substantial for
a tiny house.
Shay lives here with her husband, Kevin Martin, and their three-year-old twin boys in a 272-square-foot gooseneck trailer. And if you're wondering just how small this trailer is, picture a one-car garage. It's not much bigger than that. One of the bedrooms is a loft, which adds about another 70 square feet.
And then our bathroom is huge. The boys love baths. They actually hate showers. They were scared of them, so we knew we needed a bathtub.
About a year ago, Shay and Martin decided to downsize for several reasons, like a large mortgage and desire for more family time. So they sold their 1,100-square-foot home in Seattle, bought the tiny house, and hit the road.
We went through Oregon. We went down the coast of California. We stayed.
They've been traveling for 6 months.
And Flagstaff, and then Durango. We love Durango.
It was in Durango that they ran into trouble. The couple parked in a friend's backyard, which is illegal. Zoning regulations say you can't put a tiny house anywhere but an RV park.
We cannot buy our own property and park our tiny house on it. We could get kicked off of our own property.
This is true throughout Colorado and much of the United States.
So all cities have their own zoning rules and regulations, and they can put together what works for them and their community.
Kristen Sullivan is the director of community and economic development at Adams County. Zoning regulations do vary across the state. For example, she says in unincorporated Adams County, a single-family home must be at least 1,200 square feet, while cities and towns in the county, like Brighton, Thornton, and Bennett, also have their own building codes.
The reason why we have zoning is to create more uniform character, consistency, and predictability in neighborhoods.
Besides size restrictions, mobile tiny dwellings face another issue. In most places, houses are required to be on foundations and hooked up to public utilities.
Sometimes zoning regulations are established years ago and continue on until there's a need for change.
That change could be here. The International Residential Code, or IRC, establishes the minimum requirements for one- and two-family dwellings and townhouses. The IRC added something new this year, Appendix Q. Appendix Q provides industry-wide building standards for tiny houses 400 square feet or less.
2018, all of a sudden, the domino fell.
Michael Buccino lives in Steamboat Springs and is on the planning committee. When Rout County adopted the 2018 IRC, a path to building permanent tiny homes was cleared.
And that domino said, hey, if you want to start building, build a tiny home. Build it anywhere you want. Follow the code. The building department now becomes part of the process.
And Buccino is ready. He wants to find a 2-single-family home parcel in unincorporated Rout County and build 6 tiny houses. They would be on foundations connected to sewer, water, and electricity. But other dominoes also need to fall. Buccino says it's been hard to get a bank loan to finance the project.
There's nothing to compare it to. How much is a tiny home on a tiny piece of land in a group of 6 homes worth? No one knows.
Buccino's community won't be built anytime soon, but he is making progress. Unfortunately, for mobile tiny home dwellers who want to live off the grid, use green energy, or composting toilets, a permanent location is still only a dream. But tiny house advocates like Art LeBach hope festivals and the awareness they bring will eventually change that too.
The local jurisdictions, we want them to see how many people are interested in this.
Ali Shea and Kevin Martin are committed to tiny living. He works in digital media marketing and plans to start working remotely soon. And in a couple of years, Shay, a former teacher, will homeschool the boys. By the time the kids turn 5, they hope to own a plot of land next to other tiny home dwellers.
Hopefully there will be communities popping up, like kind of co-op communities is what a lot of us are envisioning.
But for now, Shay and her family are back on the road. She chronicles their adventures on Instagram, and a recent post is from Washington State. For KUNC, I'm Stephanie Daniel.
So, do we have any more interesting stories coming up?
Is that a trick question? Of course we do. Howie Mofsovitz reviews The King. Thank you very much. Not to mention,
that toilet has been there longer than Daddy and I have been alive.
Yeah.
Probably longer than Grandma and Grandpa have been alive.
If you need a bathroom break, hit pause now, because you don't want to miss Luke Runyon's piece on the humble household appliance that helps save thousands of gallons of water, the porcelain throne.
But before we get to that, let's grab some sunscreen and head outside. Millions of people will do just that by visiting a national park this summer. And each year, a handful of them get into trouble and need to be rescued. In Colorado, there's an incident nearly every other day in Rocky Mountain National Park. KUNC's Michael DeJoanna digs into what the numbers mean.
A relatively easy and popular hike at the park is the Alluvial Fan. The trail follows the roaring river and even includes a view of a waterfall. There are signs warning hikers about the danger of floods.
I want to give us an inch or two, too.
Last June, a team wearing yellow rain jackets and helmets had to string ropes across the raging waters. A rescuer was lowered to an 18-year-old man stranded on the rocks.
Does that help? Yeah, let's just queue him up on lockers.
He was harnessed and lifted to safety. There were 165 incidents like this in 2017, resulting in 5 deaths. And according to our analysis of national park data, that ranks Rocky Mountain National Park 3rd in the country for search and rescue operations. Only the Grand Canyon in Arizona and Yosemite National Park in California had more. In the past decade, the crowds at Rocky Mountain National Park have swelled. About 4.4 million people visited last year. On this day, a steady stream of people flow in and out of the Beaver Meadows Visitor Center. In one corner, a couple is talking with a park ranger.
About doing the Ute Trail hike.
I think it's
not recommended to do it in the
Interpretation area. Ranger Adam Auerbach gives the lay of the land.
That is up above treeline, right? So we are extreme lightning danger.
Even on a clear and sunny day like this, there are perils.
So anytime between 12 and 8, you know, up above treeline is a tremendously unsafe place to be.
Mark Pita, this is Michael.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Mark Pita is the chief ranger of Rocky Mountain National Park. We meet in his office and I ask him if search and rescue operations are a distraction.
I don't know if I'd necessarily call it a distraction. It's one of our core responsibilities.
About a third of last year's 165 incidents tapped deep into his staff.
About 50 or 55 what we call major search and rescue incidents. Those are with, you know, large amounts of people in the field. Be it a rescue or search or some kind of activity like that.
About 20 rangers and staff oversee the park's 415 square miles in the busy summer months. And during a big incident?
The majority of the staff will be pulled into it.
When that happens, dozens of outside responders and trained volunteers may also get involved. Everything from aerial support to dog teams. They're skilled in traversing extreme and challenging territory, like the 14,259-foot Long's Peak, which looms over the park.
It can drop 30, 40 degrees in minutes. Lightning, sleet, hail, high winds, clouds, iced up conditions. And that can happen in August.
9 people have died on that mountain since 2010, according to Colorado Mountaineering. The group gathers data on top hikes and climbs. And in some cases, helicopters have been used in the rescues. In 2016, 2 members of a special forces team from Fort Carson in Colorado Springs fell prey to altitude sickness. After a shaky night on the mountain, they were flown out the next day.
A lot of times these rescues, say on Long's Peak or other areas, our job is to provide patient care, often in a high alpine setting under challenging circumstances with weather and darkness and difficult terrain.
Those who are rescued in the park do not pay, though people evacuated with serious injuries may be billed by outside agencies for transportation to an emergency room. And while Rocky Mountain National Park doesn't have a dedicated search and rescue staff, it has a budget for that. $83,000 was set aside and fully used in 2017. That meant Mark Pita had to request $138,000 more for so-called non-programmed costs like overtime pay, and another $41,000 for supplies.
We have a funding that the Park Service provides to cover our overcosts or overtime and other kinds of equipment or other needs that we might have. Sometimes we hire a helicopter. So those, we get augmented on those kinds of situations, but those are emergency funding accounts. It's pretty routine for us.
If there's any good news, it's that search and rescues at national parks and other areas have been declining since the mid-1990s, according to our analysis. One possible reason for that is there are so many more people on the trails these days with their mobile phones. Yet as national visitations rose to 330 million in 2017, a nearly 8% increase over 3 years, the cost of operations hit a 3-year high at $3.3 million. For KUNC, I'm Michael DeJoanna.
Since the 1990s, there's been a strange phenomenon happening in cities throughout the West. Their populations are booming, but their overall water use is staying the same, or in some cases, it's going down.
Huh.
As a part of a series on urban water conservation, KUNC's Luke Runyon reports that a lot of credit for the savings should go to the toilet.
Teresa McFarland lives in an historic two-story home in Longmont, Colorado, with her husband and two kids. Built in 1928, it has all of the vintage touches. Hardwood floors, big windows, wood detailing, and one really old toilet.
You don't think about it. It's one of those daily things that you just do without really thinking about how much water.
A little stamp on the bowl says it was built in the 1950s. McFarland points it out to her four-year-old daughter, Althea.
That toilet has been there longer than Daddy and I have been alive.
Yeah.
Probably longer than Grandma and Grandpa have been alive.
That's why McFarland started looking for a replacement. She called up a local conservation group called Resource Central and asked if they could help her put in a new, more water-friendly model. Nika Sundlin oversees the group's Flush for the Future program. She's here today to install the latest in toilet technology.
We guesstimate this one's using about 5 gallons of flush.
Oh, that's incredible.
The new one uses less than one.
It's amazing.
It's 0.8 gallons per flush. So you're going to be saving probably 4 gallons of water per flush.
The city of Longmont also has an interest in getting rid of the McFarland family's water-guzzling toilet. The city, along with other local water providers, subsidizes the cost of installing high-efficiency toilets. Sundlin says it's an easy switch with a big payoff. With other conservation programs, you first have to convince people to use less water.
But a toilet is a toilet, and so it's no behavior change whatsoever. You just literally save water with every flush.
A toilet uses more water than any other fixture in a home. More than your washing machine, your 20-minute shower, and way more than your dishwasher. The average person flushes 5 times per day.
Most people don't realize that if their toilet is more than 10 or 15 years old, replacing their toilet, upgrading their toilet, is one of the most impactful ways they can save water.
Neil Lurie is president of Resource Central.
Can save between 200 and 300,000 gallons of water over the life of that toilet.
Back in the 1990s, Congress passed a law that created national standards for water use. It mandated toilets only use about 1.5 gallons for each flush. For the plumbing industry, it was a huge deal.
Oh, absolutely. It was an extremely watershed moment, no pun intended.
One of the people who helped write the low flush rules was Pete DeMarco. He's with the International Association of Plumbing and Mechanical Officials.
And it wasn't just toilets where flows were being reduced, but shower heads, kitchen faucets, lavatory faucets, and urinals were also being regulated.
DeMarco says this is why cities have been able to grow and still keep their water use in check. Indoor use dropped 22% nationwide between 1999 and 2016, much of that due to just swapping out old fixtures. And in recent years, some states with water scarcity problems have passed even tighter regulations on how much water toilets can use.
And so you basically have these high-efficiency toilets now as a matter of course. You cannot go out in a store in Colorado or California and buy an old toilet.
Drew Beckwith is with the environmental organization Western Resource Advocates. He says conservationists have been a victim of their own success. With national standards in place, there's not much more they can do to limit water use inside homes.
We've sort of done our business with respect to toilets, and it's time to, you know, maybe get off the pot and move on to outdoor water use, which is more, I see, the focus of urban water efficiency today.
Back at the McFarland home, their brand new toilet is hooked up, and the water is flowing. The honor of first flush goes to McFarland's daughter, Althea.
Check it out. There's this new button. Can I show you? Give it a shot.
In Longmont, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of a collaborative series from the Colorado River Reporting Project at KUNC, the Mountain West News Bureau, and Elemental, covering sustainability. If you want more, just go to KUNC.org.
The new documentary, The King, looks at the cultural and political legacy of Elvis Presley.
Hey, it's about me.
Sorry.
Apparently, it's a better movie than my Elvis Presley impersonation, according to KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz. He teaches film and television at CU Denver and says it's one of the best documentaries he's seen.
It took about 20 seconds to realize that Eugene Jarecki's The King's a necessary documentary for this moment in our history. You may wonder why it didn't come along sooner until you realize how right it is for this exact time, and it's a great film about the agony America faces now. Jarecki's done good work before this picture, but when I saw both Steven Soderbergh and Errol Morris listed as executive producers, I thought something unusual was coming, and it did. The overt subject is the career of Elvis Presley, but The King describes the phenomenon of Elvis Presley as a critical event in American history. Back in 1968, in his book Soul on Ice, Black Panther Eldridge Cleaver wrote that Elvis Presley taught the white man how to shake his ass. But that's just the most obvious thing about Presley. James Carville, the caustic political advisor, says that after Elvis Presley appeared in the world, America never tasted the same. White parents were terrified that Presley's wildness would do who knows what to their kids, those dangerous rhythms and lyrics. They preferred the dependably smooth Pat Boone. The white kids knew that their parents' take on Presley was right, that Presley did offer foreign rhythms from black America and that he was dangerous, which is just what they wanted, an antidote to a stiff, uptight, racially and culturally segregated world. But it was all far more complicated than that, and that's where The King becomes a revelation. The movie's a furious mélange of film clips, still photos, interviews, and music. The past slams against the present. Images from Presley's life and time join with America now. Presley's parents were barely working class. His father went to prison for forging a check. As a young man, Presley drove a truck and worked as an electrician. He was not yet musical, but he listened to black radio stations and went to a black church where a few other whites attended, largely to hear the music. Director Eugene Jarecki brings the film to the Stax Music Academy in Memphis, where kids now learn soul music, and so they sing and are stunningly good. But so is Emmy Sunshine, a 13-year-old white girl who belts out a white version of blues and gospel. Nothing in the film goes unchallenged. There's the standard story of Sam Phillips of Sun Records, who first recorded Presley because he'd been looking for a white singer with a black sound. Then the film brings in Van Jones, a scholarly former advisor to Barack Obama, who talks about how for black people, Presley was a thief who stole black culture for white exploitation. But then Chuck D of Public Enemy says that culture is culture open to everyone. And then there's the late blues singer Big Mama Thornton singing Hound Dog, Presley's great early hit, which he got from Thornton, who in turn got it from Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, the two white, non-Southern Jewish songwriters fundamental to rhythm and blues and rock and roll. But The King doesn't stop with cultural complexities. The film is really searching for the basic structure of American society. Its politics and social view are about the contentious state of America right now. So it looks at what went wrong with Presley, destructive celebrity, wealth, and the malevolent influence of Colonel Tom Parker, Presley's overbearing manager, who, the film notes, took 50% of Presley's earnings instead of the typical 15%. A telling film clip shows Presley just back from the Army, welcomed on a TV show by Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr., the Rat Pack. You can see that at that moment, Presley's time as a man who changed the direction of the world was over. He was sucked into the fold, and no matter how rich, drug-addled, and unhappy he would get, the corporate world had got him and neutered him. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. Editors Ashley Jeffcoat and Brian Larson contributed to our show. Ashley also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. Other music in this episode, Bellevue from C. Scott, Robbie Reverb with Motorcat and High Altitude Cocktails, and Split Phase with Catching Glitter.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
In the meantime, find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.